Chapter 34. I had never before tried swimming with my hands tied in front of me. It is my earnest hope that I never have to try it again. Only the strong salinity of this world's ocean kept me afloat as I kicked, floated, flailed, and thrashed my way north. I had no real hope of reaching the raft. The current began running strongest at least a click north of the platform, and our plan had been to keep the raft as far away from the structure as we could without losing the river within the sea. It was only a few minutes before the colored sharks began circling again. Their shimmering electric colors were visible beneath the waves, and when one moved in for the attack, I stopped trying to swim, floated, and kicked at its head in precisely the same way as I had seen the late lieutenant hold the things at bay. It seemed to work. The fish were undoubtedly deadly, but they were stupid. They attacked one at a time as if there were some unseen pecking order among them, and I kicked them in the snout one at a time. But the process was exhausting. I had started to remove my boots just before the first color shark attack. The heavy leather was dragging me down, but the thought of kicking bare feet at those fanged, bullet-shaped heads made me keep the boots on as long as I could. I also soon decided that I could not swim with the pistol in my hands. The saberback things were diving during their actual lunges at me. Coming up from beneath seemed to be their preferred mode of attack, and I doubted whether a bullet from the old slug thrower would do any good through a meter or two of water. Eventually, I tucked the pistol back into its holster, although I soon wished I had dropped it altogether. Floating, swiveling to keep twin dorsal fins in view, I finally pulled off my boots and let them slip away into the depths. When the next shark attacked, I kicked harder, feeling the sandpaper roughness of the skin above its tiny brain. It snapped at my bare feet but moved away and began circling again. This is the way I swam north. Pausing, floating, kicking, cursing, swimming a few meters, pausing again to twist in circles, waiting for the next attack. If it had not been for the combination of the brilliant moons and the saberback thing's glowing skin, one of them would have pulled me down long before. As it was, I soon reached the point where I was too exhausted to try to swim any longer. All I could do was float on my back, gasp for air, and get my feet between those white teeth and my legs every time I saw the colors flashing my way. The knife wounds were beginning to hurt in earnest now. I could feel the deeper slash along my ribs as a terrible burning combined with a stickiness down the length of my side. I was sure that I was bleeding into the water, and once, when the dorsal fins were circling far enough out that I could ignore them for a moment, I lowered my hands to my side and then pulled them out of the water. They were red, much redder than the violet sea glowing in the light of the great moon that had now cleared the horizon. I felt the weakness growing in me and realized that I was bleeding to death. The water was becoming warmer, as if my blood were heating it to a comfortable temperature, and the temptation to close my eyes and move deeper into that warmth grew stronger each minute. I admit that each time the ocean swell bore me up, I kept looking over my shoulder for some sign of the raft, for some miracle from the north. I saw nothing there. Part of me was pleased at this. The raft had probably transited the Farcaster portal by now. It had not been intercepted. I had seen no skimmers airborne, no thopters, and the platform was only a diminishing blaze to the south. I realized that my best hope was to be picked up by a searching thopter now that the raft was safely gone. But even the thought of such rescue did not cheer me. I had been to the platform once this day. Floating on my back, twisting my head and neck to keep the colored dorsals in view, I kicked my way north, rising with each great movement of the violet sea, dropping into wide troughs as the ocean seemed to breathe in. I rotated to my stomach and tried kicking more strongly, my handcuffed fists straight ahead of me. But I was too exhausted to keep my head above water that way. My right arm seemed to be bleeding more fiercely now and seemed three times as heavy as the left. I guessed that the lieutenant's blade had severed tendons there. Finally, I had to give up swimming and concentrate on floating, my feet kicking to keep me up, my head and shoulders above water, my fists clenched in front of my face. The saberback things seemed to sense my weakness. They took turns swimming at me, their great mouths open to feed. Each time I pulled my legs up and kicked straight out, trying to strike their snouts or brain pans with my heels without having my feet bitten off. Their rough skin had abraded the flesh of my heels and soles to the point that I was adding more blood to the sphere that must surround me. It made the dorsal things wilder. Their attacks came closer together as I grew too tired to pull my legs up each time. One of the long fish ripped my right pant leg off from the knee to ankle, pulling a layer of skin with it as it moved away with a triumphant stroke of its tail. Part of my tired mind had been pondering theology during all this. Not praying, but wondering about a cosmic God who allowed its creatures to torture each other like this. How many hominids, mammals, and trillions of other creatures had spent their last minutes in mortal fear such as this, their hearts pounding, their adrenaline coursing through them and exhausting them more quickly, their small minds racing in the hopeless quest of escape. How could any god describe him or herself as a god of mercy and fill the universe with fanged things such as this? I remembered Grandam telling me about an early older scientist, one Charles Darwin, who had come up with one of the early theories of evolution or gravitation or some such, and how, although raised a devout Christian even before the reward of the cruciform, he had become an atheist while studying a terrestrial wasp that paralyzed some large species of spider, planted its embryo, and let the spider recover and go about its business until it was time for the hatched wasp larvae to burrow its way out of the living spider's abdomen. I shook water out of my eyes and kicked at two of the dorsal fins rushing at me. I missed the head but struck one of the sensitive fins. Only by pulling my legs up into a ball did I avoid that snapping maw. Losing my buoyancy for a moment, I went a meter or more under the next wave, swallowed salt water, and came up gasping and blind. More fins circled closer. Swallowing water again, I struggled with my numb hands underwater and came up with the pistol, almost dropping it before propping it against my chin. I realized that it would be easier just to leave the muzzle under my chin and pull the trigger than to try to use it against these sea killers. Well, there were quite a few slugs left in the thing. I had not used it during all of the excitement of the last couple of hours, so it would remain an option. Swiveling, watching the closest dorsal move even closer, I remembered a story Grandam had read me when I was a boy. It was also an ancient classic, a thing by Stephen Crane called The Open Boat. And it was about several men who had survived the sinking of their ship and days at sea without water, only to be stuck a few hundred meters from land by surf too high to cross without capsizing. One of the men in the boat, I could not remember which character, had moved through all of the circles of theological supposition, praying, believing that God was a merciful deity who sat up nights worrying about him, then believing that God was a cruel bastard, and finally deciding that no one was listening. I realized now that I had not understood that story, despite Grandam's Socratic questions and careful guidance. I thought that I remembered the weight of epiphany that had fallen on that character as he realized they would have to swim for it, and that not all of them could survive. He had wanted nature, for this is how he now thought of the universe, to be a huge glass building, just so that he could cast stones at it. But even that, he realized, would be useless. The universe is indifferent to our fates. This was the crushing burden that the character took with him as he struggled through the surf towards survival or extinction. The universe just does not give a shit. I realized that I was laughing and weeping at the same time, shouting curses and invitations to the saberback things that were only 2 or 3 meters out. I leveled the pistol and fired at the closest fin. Amazingly, the soaked slug thrower fired. The noise that had been so loud on the raft now seemed to be swallowed by the waves and immensity of the sea. The fish dived out of sight. 2 more lunged at me. I shot at one, kicked at the other, just as something struck me hard on the neck from behind. I was not so lost in theology and philosophizing that I was ready to die. I swiveled quickly, not knowing how badly I had been bitten, but determined to shoot the goddamn thing in the mouth if I had to. I had the heavy pistol cocked and aimed before I saw the girl's face there, half a meter from my own. Her hair was plastered to her skull and her dark eyes were bright in the moonlight. "Rawl!" She must have been calling my name before, but I had not heard it over the gunshot and the rushing in my ears. I blinked salt water away. This could not be real. Oh, Jesus, why should she be out here, away from the raft? "Rawl!" Ania called again. "Float on your back. Use the gun to keep those things away. I'll pull you in." I shook my head. I did not understand. Why would she leave the powerful android on the raft and come after me by herself? How could... A. Bedick's blue scalp became visible over the next large swell. The android was swimming strongly with both arms, the long machete clamped in his white teeth. I confess that I laughed through my tears. He looked like a cheap Hollows version of a pirate. "Float on your back!" shouted the girl again. I turned on my back, too tired to kick, as a shark thing lunged at my legs. I shot between my feet at it, striking it square between its black, lifeless eyes. The 2 fins disappeared beneath the wave. Ania set 1 arm around my neck, her left hand under my right arm so she was not choking me, and began swimming strongly up the next huge swell. A. Bedick swam alongside, paddling with 1 arm now as he wielded the sharp machete with another. I saw him slice into the water and watched 2 dorsal fins shudder and swerve to the right. "What are you?" I began, choking and coughing. "Save your breath," gasped the girl, pulling me down into the next trough and up the violet wall ahead of us. "We have a long way to go." "The pistol," I said, trying to hand it to her. I felt the darkness closing on my vision, like a narrowing tunnel, and did not want to lose the weapon. Too late. I felt it drop away into the sea. "Sorry," I managed, before the tunnel closed completely. My last conscious thought was an inventory of what I had lost on my first solo expedition. The treasured hawking mat, my night goggles, the antique automatic pistol, my boots, probably the comm unit, and quite possibly my life and the lives of my friends. Total darkness cut off the end of this cynical speculation. I was vaguely aware of their lifting me onto the raft. The handcuffs were gone, cut away. The girl was breathing into my mouth, pumping water out of my lungs with pressure against my chest. A. Bedick knelt next to us, pulling strongly on a heavy line. After retching water for several minutes, I said, "The raft, how... It should have been to the portal by now. I don't..." Ania pushed my head back against a pack and cut away rags of my shirt and right trouser leg with a short knife. "A. Bedick rigged a sort of sea anchor using the micro tent and the climbing rope," she said. "It's dragging behind, slowing us down but keeping us on course. It gave us time to find you."
"How?"
I began, then started coughing salt water again. "Hush," said the girl, ripping the last of my shirt away. "I want to see how badly you're hurt." I winced as her strong hands touched the great gash in my side. Her fingers found the deep cut on my upper arm, ran down my side to where the fish had taken the skin down my thigh and calf.
"Ah, Rawl," she said sadly. "I let you out of my sight for an hour or two, and look what you do to yourself."
The weakness was overwhelming me again. the darkness returning. I knew that I had lost too much blood. I was very cold. "I'm sorry," I whispered.
"Quiet."
She tore open the larger of our med packs with a loud ripping noise.
"Hush."
"No," I insisted. "I screwed up. I was supposed to be your protector. Guard you." "Sorry," I cried out as she poured antiseptic sulfa solution directly into the wound on my side. I had seen men weep at this on the battlefield. Now I was one of them. If it had been my modern med pack that the girl had opened, I am sure I would have died minutes, if not seconds, later. But it was the larger pack, the ancient force-issue med pack we'd taken from the ship. My first thought was that all of the medicines and instruments would be useless after so long a time. But then I saw the blinking lights on the surface of the pack she had laid on my chest. Some were green, more were yellow, a few were red. I knew that this was not good.
"Lie back," whispered Aenea, and tore open a sterile suture pack.
She laid the clear bag against my side, and the millipede suture within came to life and crawled to my wound. The sensation was not pleasant as the tailored life form crawled into the ragged walls of my wound, secreted its antibiotic and cleansing secretions, then drew its sharp millipede legs together in a tight suture. I cried out again, then again a moment later as she applied another millipede suture to my arm.
"We need more plasma cartridges," she said to
Abetic as she fed two of the small cylinders into the pack injection system. I felt the burn on my thigh as the plasma entered my system.
"Those four are all that we have," said the android.
He was busy working on me now, setting an osmosis mask in place over my face. Pure oxygen began to flow into my lungs.
"Damn,"
said the girl, injecting the last of the plasma cartridges.
"He's lost too much blood. He's going into deep shock."
I wanted to argue with them, explain that my shaking and shivering was just a result of the cold air, that I felt much better. But the osmosis mask pressed everywhere against my mouth, eyes, nose, and did not allow me to speak. For a moment, I hallucinated that we were back in the ship, and the crash field was holding me secure again. I think that all the salt water on my face at that moment was not from the sea. Then I saw the ultramorph injector in the girl's hands, and I began to struggle. I did not want to be knocked out. If I was going to die, I wanted to be awake when it happened. Aenea pushed me back against the med pack. She understood what I was trying to say.
"I want you out, Rawl," she said softly. "You're going into shock. We need to get your vital signs stabilized. It'll be easier if you're out."
The injector hissed. I thrashed for another few seconds, weeping tears of frustration now. After all that effort to slip away while unconscious. God damn it. It wasn't fair. It wasn't right. I awoke to bright sunlight and terrible heat. For a moment, I was sure that we were still on the sea of Mare Infinitus. But when I worked up enough energy to lift my head, I could see that the sun was different, larger, hotter, and the sky was a much paler shade of blue. The raft seemed to be moving along some sort of concrete canal with only a meter or two to spare on either side. I could see concrete, sun, and blue sky, nothing else.
"Lie back," said Aenea,
pushing my head and shoulders back on the pack and adjusting the micro-tent fabric so that my face was in shade again. Obviously, they had retrieved their sea anchor. I tried to speak, failed, licked dry lips that seemed stitched together, and finally managed. "How long have I been out?" Aenea gave me a sip of water from my own canteen before replying.
"About 30 hours.
30 hours? Even trying to shout, I could do little more than squeak.
A. Bettick came around the side of the tent and crouched in the shade with us.
"Welcome back, Emendymion."
"Where are we?"
Ania answered.
"Judging from the desert, sun, and the stars last night, it's almost certain that we're on Hebron. We seem to be traveling along some aqueduct. Right now, well, you should see this."
She supported my shoulders so I could see over the concrete lip of the canal. Nothing but air and distant hills.
"We're about 50 meters up on this section of aqueduct," she said,
lowering my head to the pack again.
"It's been like this for the last 5 or 6 clicks. If there's been a breach in the aqueduct," she smiled ruefully, "we haven't seen anyone or anything, not even a vulture. We're waiting until we come into a city."
I frowned, feeling the stiffness in my side and arm as I shifted position ever so slightly. "Hebron, I thought it was..."
"Captured by the Austers," finished A. Bettick.
"Yes, that was our information as well. It does not matter, sir. We will seek medical care for you with the Austers as happily, more happily, than we would with the packs."
I looked down at the med pack now lying next to me. Filaments ran to my chest, arm, and legs. Most of the lights on the pack were blinking amber. This was not good.
"Your wounds are sealed and cleaned," said Ania. "We gave you all the plasma the old pack had, but you need more. And there seems to be some sort of infection the multispectrum antibiotics can't handle."
That explained the terrible feverish quality I felt beneath my skin.
"Perhaps some microorganism in the sea on Mare Infinitus," said A. Bettick. "The med pack cannot quite diagnose it. We will know when we get to a hospital. It is our guess that this section of the Tethys will lead to Hebron's one large city."
"New Jerusalem," I whispered.
"Yes," said the android. "Even after the fall, it was famous for its Sinai Medical Center."
I started to shake my head, but stopped when the pain and dizziness struck. "But the Austers?"
Ania moved a damp cloth across my brow.
"We're going to get help for you," she said, "Austers or no Austers."
A thought was trying to burrow up out of my befuddled brain. I waited until it arrived. "Hebron didn't have... I don't think it had..."
"You are right, sir," said A. Bettick. He tapped the small book in his hand. "According to the guide, Hebron was not part of the River Tethys and allowed only a single Farcaster Terminex in New Jerusalem, even during the height of the web. Off-world visitors were not allowed to leave the capital. They treasured privacy and independence here."
I looked out at the passing aqueduct walls. Suddenly we were off the high trestle and moving between high dunes and sun-baked rocks. The heat was terrible.
"But the book must have been wrong," said Ania, mopping my brow again. "The Farcaster portal was there, and we're here."
"You're sure it's Hebron?" I whispered.
Ania nodded. A. Bettick held up the comlog bracelet. I had forgotten about it.
"Our mechanical friend here got a reliable star sighting," he said. "We are on Hebron, and I would guess only hours away from New Jerusalem."
Pain tore through me then, and no matter how I tried to hide it, I must have writhed. Ania brought the ultramorph injector out.
"No," I said through cracked lips. "This is the last one for a while," she whispered.
I heard the hiss and felt the blessed numbness spreading. "If there is a God," I thought, "it's a painkiller." When I awoke again, the shadows were long and we were in the shade of a low building. A. Bettick was carrying me from the raft. Each step sent pain racking through me. I made no sound. Ania was walking ahead. The street was wide and dusty, the buildings low, none over 3 stories.
and made of an adobe-like material. No one was in sight.
"Hello?"
called the child, cupping her hands to her mouth. The two syllables echoed down the empty street. I felt foolish being carried like a child, but A. Bedick did not seem to mind, and I knew that I could not stand if my life depended upon it. Ania walked back to us, saw my open eyes, and said,
"This is New Jerusalem. There's no doubt. According to the guidebook, 3 million people lived here during the Web days, and A. Bedick says that there were at least 1 million still here the last he heard."
"Ousters," I managed. Ania nodded tersely.
"The shops and buildings near the canal were empty, but they looked like they'd been lived in until a few weeks or months ago."
A. Bedick said, "According to the transmissions we monitored on Hyperion, this world was supposed to have fallen to the Ousters approximately 3 standard years ago, but there are signs of habitation here much more recent than that."
"The power grid's still on," said Ania. "Food that was left out is all spoiled, but the fridge compartments are still cold. Tables are set in some of the houses, hollow pits humming with static, radios hissing, but no people."
"But also no signs of violence," said the android, laying me carefully in the back of a ground car with a flat metal bed behind the cab. Ania had set out a blanket to keep my skin away from the hot metal. The pain in my side sent spots dancing in front of my eyes. Ania rubbed her arms. There were goosebumps there despite the blazing heat of the evening.
"But something terrible happened here," she said. "I can feel it."
I admit that I felt nothing but pain and fever. My thoughts were like mercury, always shifting away before I could grab them or form them into a cohesive shape. Ania jumped up onto the flatbed of the ground car and crouched next to me, while A. Bedick opened the door to the cab and crawled in. Amazingly, the vehicle started with a touch of the ignition plate. "I can drive this," said the android, putting the vehicle in gear. "So can I thought at them. "I drove one like it in Ursus. It's one of the few things in the universe I know how to operate. It may be one of the few things I can do right." We bumped down the main street. The pain made me cry out a few times despite my best efforts to stay quiet. I clamped my jaws tight. Ania was holding my hand. Her fingers felt so cool that they almost made me shiver. I realized that my own skin was on fire.
"It's that damned infection," she was saying. "Otherwise you'd be recovering now, something in that ocean."
"Or on his knife," I whispered. I closed my eyes and saw the lieutenant flying to pieces as the fleshhead clouds tore into him. I opened my eyes to escape the image. The buildings were taller here, 10 stories at least, and they cast a deeper shade. But the heat was terrible.
"A friend of my mother's on the last Hyperion pilgrimage lived here for a while," she was saying.
Her voice seemed to move in and out of hearing range, like a poorly tuned radio station. "Saw Weintraub," I croaked. "The scholar in the old poet's cantos." Ania patted my hand.
"I forget that everything Mother lived has become grist for Uncle Martin's legend mill."
We bounced over a bump. I ground my back teeth together to keep from screaming. Ania's grip on my hand intensified.
"Yes," she said. "I wish I had met the old scholar and his daughter."
"They went ahead. In the Sphinx," I managed. "Like you did." Ania leaned close, moistened my lips from the canteen, and nodded.
"Yes. But I remember Mother's stories about Hebron and the kibbutzim here."
"Jews," I whispered, and then quit talking. It took too much energy that I needed to fight the pain.
"They fled the Second Holocaust,"
she said, looking ahead now as the ground car rounded a corner.
"They called their hegira the diaspora."
I closed my eyes,
The lieutenant flew apart, his clothing and flesh mangled to long streamers that spiraled slowly down to the violet sea. Suddenly, A. Bettick was lifting me. We were entering a building larger and more sinuous than the others, all soaring plasteel and tempered glass. "The medical center," the android said. The automatic door whispered open ahead of us. "It has power. Now, if only the medical machinery is intact." I must have dozed briefly, for when I opened my eyes again, terrified because the twin dorsal fins were circling closer and closer, I was on a gurney trolley being slid into a long cylinder of some sort of diagnostic autosurgeon. "See you later," Ania was saying, releasing my hand. "See you on the other side." We were on Hebron for 13 of its local days, each day being some 29 standard hours. For the first 3 days, the autosurgeon had its way with me. No fewer than 8 invasive surgeries and an even dozen therapy treatments, according to the digitized record at the end. It was indeed some microorganism from that miserable ocean on Mare Infinitus that had decided to kill me. Although when I saw the magnetic resonance and deep bioradar scans, I realized that the organism had not been so micro after all. Whatever it was, the autodiagnostic equipment was ambivalent, had taken hold along the inside of my scraped rib and grown like fen fungus until it had begun to branch out to my internal organs. Another standard day without surgery, the autosurgeon reported later, and they would have made the initial incision to find only lichen and liquefaction. After opening me up, cleaning me out, and then repeating the process twice more when infinitesimal traces of the ocean-born organism started colonizing again, the autosurgeon pronounced the fungus kaput and began working on my lesser life-threatening wounds. The knife cut in the side had opened me up enough that I should have bled to death, especially with all of my kicking and high pulse rate brought on by my dorsaled friends in the sea. Evidently, the plasma cartridges in the old med pack and several days of being kept near comatose by Aenea's liberal doses of ultramorph had kept me alive until the surgeon could transfuse 8 more units of plasma into me. The deep wound in my arm had not, as I had feared, severed tendons, but enough important muscles and nerves had been slashed that the autosurgeon had worked on that arm during operations 2 and 3. Because the hospital still had power when we arrived, the surgeon had taken it upon its own silicon initiative to have the organ tanks in the basement grow the replacement nerves I needed. On the 8th day, when Aenea sat at my bedside and told me how the autosurgeon repeatedly kept asking for advice and authorization from its human overseers, I was even able to laugh when she talked of how Dr. Bettick authorized each critical operation, transplant, and therapy. The leg the color shark had tried to bite off turned out to be the most painful part of the ordeal. After the infinitus fungus had been cleaned out of the area laid bare by the shark's teeth, new skin and muscle tissue had been transplanted layer by layer. It hurt. And after it quit hurting, it itched. During my 2nd week of confinement in that hospital, I was undergoing ultramorph withdrawal and would seriously have considered holding my pistol on the girl or the android and demanding morph if I had actually believed they could be intimidated into bringing me relief from withdrawal symptoms and that hellish itching. But the pistol was gone, sunk in the bottomless violet sea. It was on about the 8th day when I could sit up in bed and actually eat food, although just bland, vat-replicated hospital food, that I talked to Aenea about my short stint as hero. "On my last night on Hyperion, I got drunk with the old poet and promised him I'd accomplish certain things on this trip," I said. "What things?" said the girl, her spoon in my dish of green gelatin. "Nothing much," I said. "Protect you, get you home, find old Earth and bring it back so he could see it again before he died." Aenea paused in her gelatin eating.
Her dark eyebrows were very high on her forehead.
He told you to bring old Earth back? Interesting.
That's not all, I said. Along the way, I was supposed to talk to the Ousters, destroy the Pax, overthrow the Church, and, I quote, find out what the fuck the Techno Corps is up to and stop it.
Anea set her spoon down and dabbed at her lips with my napkin. Is that all?
Not quite, I said, leaning back into the pillows. He also wanted me to keep the Shrike from hurting you or destroying humanity. She nodded.
Is that it?
I rubbed my sweaty forehead with my good left hand. I think so. At least that's all I remember. I was drunk, as I said. I looked at the child. How am I doing with the list?
Anea made that casting away gesture with her slender hands. Not bad. You have to remember that we've only been at this a few standard months. Less than three, actually.
Yeah, I said, looking out the window at the low shafts of sunlight striking the tall adobe buildings across from the hospital. Beyond the city, I could see the rocky hills burning red with evening light. Yeah, I said again, all of the energy and amusement drained from my voice. I'm doing great. I sighed and pushed the dinner tray farther away. One thing I don't understand, even in all that confusion. I don't know why their radar didn't track the raft when we were so close.
A Bedic shot it out, said the girl, working on the green gelatin again.
Say what?
A Bedic shot it out, the radar dish, with your plasma rifle.
She finished the green goop and set the spoon in place. During the last week, she had been nurse, doctor, chef, and bottle washer. I thought he said he could not shoot at humans, I said.
He can't, said Anea, clearing the tray and setting it on a nearby dresser. I asked him, but he said that there was no prohibition against his shooting as many radar dishes as he wanted. So he did, before we fixed your position and dived in to save you.
That was a 3 or 4 click shot, I said, from a pitching raft. How many pulse bolts did he use?
One, said Anea.
She was looking at the monitor readouts above my head. I whistled softly. I hope he never gets mad at me, even from a distance.
I think you'd have to be a radar dish before you'd have to worry, she said, tucking in the clean sheets.
Where is he?
Anea walked to the window and pointed east. He found an EMV that had a full charge and was checking out the kibbutzim way out toward the Great Salt Sea.
All the others have been empty?
Every one. Not even a dog, cat, horse, or pet chipmunk left behind.
I knew that she was not kidding. We had all talked about it. When communities are evacuated in a hurry, or when disaster strikes, pets are often left behind. Packs of wild dogs had been a problem during the South Talon uprising on Aquila. The Home Guard had to shoot former pets on sight. That means they had time to take their pets with them, I said. Anea turned toward me and crossed her thin arms.
And leave their clothes behind? And their computers, comm logs, private diaries, family holos, all their personal junk?
And none of those tell you what happened? No final diary entries, no surveillance cameras, or frenzied last-minute comm log entries?
Nope, said the girl. At first I was reluctant to intrude into their private comm logs and such. But by now I've played back dozens of them. During the last week, there was the usual news of the fighting nearby. The Great Wall was less than a light year away, and the Pax ships were filling the system. They didn't come down to the planet much, but it was obvious that Hebron would have to join the Pax Protectorate after it was all over. Then there were some final newscasts about the Ousters breaking through the lines, then nothing. Our guess is that the Pax evacuated the entire population, and then the Ousters moved on. But there's no notice of evacuation in the news hollows, or in the computer entries, or anywhere. It's like the people just disappeared.
She rubbed her arms. I have some of the holocast discs if you want to see them.
Maybe later, I said. I was very tired.
A. Bettick will be back in the morning, she said, pulling the thin blanket up to my chin.
Beyond the window. The sun had set, but the hills literally glowed from stored-up light. It was a twilight effect of the stones on this world that I thought I would never tire of watching. But right then, I could not keep my eyes open. Do you have the shotgun? I mumbled. The plasma rifle? Bettick gone, all alone here.
They're on the raft, said Anea. Now go to sleep.
On the first day I was fully conscious, I tried to thank both of them for saving my life. They resisted. How did you find me? I asked.
It wasn't hard, said the girl. You left the mic open, right up to the time the PAC's officer stabbed it and broke it. We could hear everything, and we could see you through the binoculars.
You shouldn't have both left the raft, I said. It was too dangerous.
Not really, Amendymion, said A. Bettick. Besides rigging the sea anchor, which slowed the raft's progress considerably, Emania had the idea of tying one of the climbing ropes to a small log for flotation and allowing the line to trail behind the raft for almost 100 meters. If we could not catch up to the raft, we felt certain we could get you back to the trailing line before it moved out of reach. And, as events showed, we did.
I shook my head. It was still stupid.
You're welcome, said the girl.
On the 10th day, I tried standing. It was a short-lived victory, but a victory nonetheless. On the 12th day, I walked the length of the corridor to the toilet there. That was a major victory. On the 13th day, the power failed all over the city. Emergency generators in the hospital basement kicked in, but we knew our time there was limited. I wish we could take the auto surgeon with us, I said as we sat on the 9th floor terrace that last evening, looking down on the shadowed avenues.
It would fit on the raft, said A. Bettick, but the extension cord would be a problem.
Seriously, I said, trying not to sound like the paranoid, victimized, demoralized patient that I was then. We need to check the pharmacies here for stuff we need.
Done, said Anea. 3 new and improved med packs, 1 whole pouch of plasma ampules, a portable diagnosticator, Ultramorph, but don't ask, you aren't getting any today.
I held out my left hand. See this? It just stopped shaking this afternoon. I won't be asking for any again soon. Anea nodded. Overhead, feathery clouds glowed with the last evening light. How long do you think these generators will hold out? I said to the android. The hospital was one of only a handful of city buildings still lighted.
A few weeks, perhaps, said A. Bettick. The power grid has been repairing and running itself for months, but the planet is harsh. You've noticed the dust storms that sweep in from the desert each morning, and even though the technology is quite advanced for a non-PAX world, the place needs humans to maintain it.
Entropy is a bitch, I said.
Now, now, said Anea from where she was leaning on the terrace wall. Entropy can be our friend.
When? I said. She turned around so that she was leaning back on her elbows. The building behind her was a dark rectangle, serving to highlight the glow of her sunburned skin.
It wears down empires, she said, and does in despotisms.
That's a hard phrase to say quickly, I said. What despotisms are we talking about here? Anea made that casting away gesture, and for a minute I thought she was not going to speak, but then she said,
The Huns, the Scythians, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Egyptians, Macedonians, Romans, and Assyrians.
Yeah, I said, but
the Avars and the Northern Way, she continued, and the Huanwans, the Mamelukes, the Persians, Arabs, Abbasids, and Seljuks.
Okay, I said, but I don't see. The Kurds and Ghaznavids, she continued, smiling now. Not to mention the Mongols, Sui, Tang, Boumanids, Crusaders, Cossacks, Prussians, Nazis, Soviets, Japanese, Javanese, North Amers, Greater Chinese, Columperos, and Antarctic Nationalists. I held up a hand. She stopped. Looking at Abedic, I said, I don't even know these planets, do you? The android's expression was neutral. I believe they all relate to old Earth, Emendymion. No shit, I said. No shit is, I believe, correct in this context, Abedic said in a flat tone. I looked back at the girl. So this is our plan to topple the packs for the old poet? Hide out somewhere and wait for entropy to take its toll? She crossed her arms again. Uh-uh, she said. Normally that would have been a good plan. Just hunker down for a few millennia and let time take its course. But these damn cruciforms complicate the equation. How do you mean? I said, my voice serious. Even if we wanted to topple the packs, she said, which, by the way, I don't. That's your job. But even if we wanted to, entropy's not on our side anymore with that parasite that can make people almost immortal. Almost immortal, I murmured. When I was dying, I must admit that I thought of the cruciform. It would have been a lot easier, not to mention less painful than all the surgery and recovery, just to die and let the thing resurrect me. Anea was looking at me. Finally, she said, That's why this planet had the best medical care in or out of the packs. Why? I said. My head was still thick with drugs and fatigue. They were... are... Jews, the girl said softly. Very few accepted the cross. They only had one chance at life. We sat for some time without speaking that evening, as the shadows filled the city canyons of New Jerusalem. And the hospital hummed with electric life while it still could. The next morning, I walked as far as the old ground car that had hauled me to the hospital 13 days earlier, but sitting in the back where they had made a mattress bed for me, I gave orders to find a gun shop. After an hour of driving around, it became obvious that there were no gun shops in New Jerusalem. All right, I said, a police headquarters. There were several of these. As I hobbled into the first one we encountered, waving away offers from both girl and android to act as a crutch, I soon discovered how underarmed a peaceful society could be. There were no weapons racks there, not even riot guns or stunners. I don't suppose Hebron had an army or home guard. I said. I believe not, replied Abedic. Until the Auster incursion 3 standard years ago, there were no human enemies or dangerous animals on the planet. I grunted and kept looking. Finally, after breaking open a triple-locked drawer in the bottom of some police chief's desk, I found something. A Steiner Ginn, I believe, said the android. A pistol firing reduced-charge plasma bolts. I know what it is, I said. There were 2 magazines in the drawer. That should be about 60 bolts. I went outside, aimed the weapon at a distant hillside, and squeezed the trigger ring. The pistol coughed and the hillside showed a tiny flash. Good, I said, fitting the old weapon in my empty holster. I was afraid that it would be a signature weapon, capable of being fired only by its owner. Those weapons went in and out of vogue over the centuries. We have the Flechette pistol on the raft, began Abedic. I shook my head. I wanted nothing to do with those things for a good while. Abedic and Anea had stocked up on water and food while I had been recuperating. And by the time I hobbled to the landing at the canal and looked at our refitted and refurbished raft, I could see the extra boxes. Question, I said. Why are we going on with this floating wood pile when there are comfortable little runabout boats tied up over there?
Or we could take an EMV and travel in air-conditioned comfort.
The girl and the blue-skinned man exchanged glances.
We voted while you were recovering, she said. We go on with the raft.
Don't I get a vote?
I snapped. I had meant to feign anger, but when it came, it was real enough.
Sure,
said the girl, standing on the dock with her feet planted, legs apart, and her hands on her hips.
Vote.
I vote we get an EMV and travel in comfort, I said, hearing the petulant tone in my voice, and hating it even while continuing it. Or even one of these boats. I vote we leave these logs behind.
Vote recorded, said the girl. A. Bedick and I voted to keep the raft. It's not going to run out of power, and it can float. One of these boats would have shown up on the radar on Mare Infinitus, and an EMV couldn't have made the trip on some worlds. Two for keeping the raft, one against. We keep it.
Who made this a democracy? I demanded.
I admit that I had images of spanking this kid.
Who made it anything else? Said the girl.
All through this, A. Bedick stood by the edge of the dock, fiddling with a rope. His face a study in that embarrassed expression that most people get when around members of another family squabbling. He was wearing a loose tunic and baggy shorts made of yellow linen. There was a wide-brimmed yellow hat on his head. Aeneas stepped onto the raft and loosened the stern line.
You want a boat or an EMV, or a floating couch for that matter, you take it, Rawl. A. Bedick and I are going on in this.
I started hobbling toward a nice little dinghy tied up along the dock.
Wait, I said, pivoting on my stronger leg to look at her again. The Farcaster won't work if I try to go through alone.
Right, said the girl.
A. Bedick had stepped aboard the raft, and now she cast off the forward line. The canal was much wider here than it had been in the concrete trough of the aqueduct, about 30 meters across as it ran through New Jerusalem. A. Bedick stood at the steering oar and looked at me as the girl picked up one of the longer poles and pushed the raft away from the dock.
Wait, I said. God damn it, wait!
I hobbled down the pier, jumped the meter or so to the raft, landed on my recuperating leg, and had to catch myself with my good arm before I rolled into the micro-tent. Aeneas offered me her hand, but I ignored it as I got to my feet.
God, you're a stubborn brat, I said.
Look who's talking, said the girl,
and went forward to sit at the front of the raft as we moved into the center current. Out of the shade of the buildings, Hebron's sun was even fiercer. I pulled on my old tricorn cap for a bit of shade as I stood by the steering oar with A. Bedick.
I imagine you're on her side, I said at last as we moved into the open desert, and the river narrowed to a canal once again.
I am quite neutral, Emendymion, said the blue-skinned man.
Ha, I said, you voted to stay with the raft.
It has served us well so far, sir, said the android, stepping back as I hobbled closer and took the steering oar in my hands. I looked at the new crates of provisions, stacked neatly in the shade of the tent, at the stone hearth with its heating cube and pots and pans, at the shotgun and plasma rifle, freshly oiled and laid under canvas covers, and at our packs, sleeping bags, med kits, and other stuff. The forward mast had been raised while I was gone, and now one of A. Bedick's extra white shirts flew from it like a flapping pennant.
Well, I said at last, screw it.
Precisely, sir, said the android. The next portal was only 5 clicks out of town. I squinted up at Hebron's blazing sun as we passed through the arch's thin shadow, then into the line of the portal itself. With the other Farcaster portals, there had been a moment when the air within shimmered and changed, giving us a glance at what lay ahead. Here, there was only absolute blackness. And the blackness did not change as we continued on. The temperature dropped at least 70 degrees centigrade. At the same instant, the gravity changed. It suddenly felt as if I were carrying someone my own mass on my back.
The lamps, I called, still holding the steering oar against a suddenly strong current. I was struggling to stay on my feet against the terrible drag of increased gravity there. The combination of chilling cold, absolute blackness, and oppressive weight was terrifying. The two had loaded lanterns they had found in New Jerusalem, but it was the old hand lamp that Aenea flicked on first. Its beam cut through icy vapor, across black water, and lifted to illuminate a roof of solid ice some 15 meters above us. Stalactites of patterned ice hung down almost to the water. Daggers of ice protruded from the black current on either side and ahead of us. Far ahead, about where the beam began to dim at 100 meters or so, there seemed to be a solid wall of icy blocks running right down to the water's surface. We were in an ice cave, and one with no visible way out. The cold burned at my exposed hands, arms, and face. The gravity lay on my neck like so many iron collars. "Damn," I said. I locked the steering oar in place and hobbled toward the packs. It was hard to stay upright with a bad leg and 80 kilos on my back. A. Bedick and the girl were already there, digging for our insulated clothing. Suddenly, there was a loud crack. I looked up, expecting to see a stalactite falling on us or the roof caving in under this terrible weight. But it was only our mast snapping where it had struck a low-hanging shelf of ice. The mast fell much faster than it would have in Hyperion gravity, rushing to the raft as if someone had fast-forwarded a hollow. Wood chips flew as it hit. A. Bedick's shirt struck the raft with an audible crash. It was frozen solid and covered with a thin coat of hoarfrost. "Damn," I said again, my teeth chattering, and dug for my woolen undies.